Do you think we can expect,
if we go to Positive World, a return to sort of mediocre kind of Christian rock music? That
please, maybe Creed will do the halftime show again. Bring that's this right. back full circle. What?
Creed, Carmen. Are we going to get Carmen? Are we going to get Petra?
Welcome to the Stand Firm Podcast. We are recording this episode on Tuesday, February the 11th, 2025. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm here with Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, and J.D. Koch of St. Luke's Anglican Church on Hilton Island, South Carolina. How are you guys doing today?
Excellent.
Great.
How are you?
Thanks, Nick.
Are you Super Bowl watchers? Did you watch the game, watch the ads? What jumped out at you? Obviously, we had another lame he gets us at. Anything else?
I didn't really watch the game. I was planning on watching the second half, thinking it was going to be tight. And then by the time I got to it after the halftime show, I was like, well, I guess I'll just, I wish I'd, I'm not, I can't stand sports betting. I think it's destroying all of the games that it is infiltrating. That being said, I don't know who had the, you know, $1,000 for Eagles by 20 or whatever. That guy is sitting pretty right now. So
yeah, it was a throwback to the 1990s where the NFC always wiped the floor with the AFC. Old school.
This was a Super Bowl in my youth when everyone, I mean, it's always boring when I was a kid. Like, yeah, it was always a blowout one way or the other. So this is the same thing. The thing I just, you know, I usually don't like the halftime show anyway, because I don't understand what's going on with all the gyrating and dancing and the simulated porn on the screen. But then that was like, I think 2 years ago, I think there was like these two women, females who were just, it was full on clothed pornography with kids gathered around to watch Super Bowl. This one was just incomprehensible. I had no idea what was going on. I couldn't understand what was being sung. Maybe it's just because I'm not a boomer, but maybe I'm an
old white man.
Yeah, old white man. No idea what's going on, and it seemed like nobody in the crowd really was getting it either, though. From what I was seeing in when they panned the crowd, and Megyn Kelly, who was there, said everyone was kind of just looking around at each other, like, also baffled by what was happening.
I kind of knew a little bit about it just because I had followed some of the people on Twitter that were talking about the feud between that guy and Drake or something like this. Yes. But yeah, I was just disappointed because I was looking forward to the Illuminati conspiratorists, exegeting the halftime show along, you know, satanic ritual lines, because that's always fun. You could just Google, you know, between the opening of new mines in various European countries all the way to the Olympic Games opening ceremonies and then the halftime show. It is argued that these are the places where the dark overlords mock us openly with their nefarious plans for the future. So, I mean, I haven't seen anything pop up about this. So that's one additional negative to the underwhelming halftime show.
I tweeted that under Anglican nationalism, we'll have the King's College Choir every halftime show from now on. Once we're elected.
I mean, they should go back.
Anglican nationalism, at least get like Aerosmith or something.
No, we would get, obviously, like, it would be like I'm trying to think, the Beatles cover band. I mean, that would be Anglican nationalism, right? I don't know why they don't go back to doing something everyone likes, like dogs catching frisbees or people winning $1 million for throwing, footballs through hoops or whatever. Like, everyone likes that. Or they could have something that people would find exciting, but, you know, they didn't ask me, so. There you go. I haven't even really watched any of the ads except for a weird clip of the one that Kanye apparently posted about his new teeth. Did you see that?
What? I feel like I watched most of it. Didn't see an ad about Kanye's teeth.
Maybe, I don't know. It was in the flurry of things, which I'm grateful for, Twitter ad blocking or whatever content filtering, because apparently he had some sort of meltdown and then started posting all this porn and then deleted his account. Yeah, that was Yeah, interesting spectacle.
People are saying is that the general vibe of the ads was more sort of pro-America, pro-family than normal. In fact, that the quote-unquote wokest ad was the one that was put out by professing Christians, the He Gets Us, which had nothing to do, of course, not that they ever have, with what Jesus actually came to do for us, but that he sort of quote-unquote understands us in some disconnected way, specifically having to do with immigration and same-sex unions, etc.
So I have a question for you about this quote-unquote vibe shift here, because it's been so fast and it's been so comprehensive, you know, up and down the line almost with respect to all of the I mean, think of Dylan Mulvaney, you know, just a couple of years ago and the you know, that guy that was parading around the White House as like a correspondent. And so were all of the companies that got behind this, is it that they are sort of agnostic, amoral pragmatists who just go with whatever makes the most money? Or yes. There was no actual ideology behind any of it. It was just pragmatism. They thought that people were going to buy more Bud Light because they had a trans guy on the can, and they were wrong. And so it was a really miscalculated risk that they took. Is that what we're going with? I mean, that's.
I think so.
I don't know. What I'd like to think is happening is that there was a fear, a cultural fear that was being pushed by a few loud voices, that when we finally got tired enough, our skin got thick enough of being called whatever, homophobes, racists, transphobes, xenophobes, whatever phobe, that the people who finally found a backbone or a thick enough skin spoke back up or pushed back up and righted the ship, or at least or turned it back the other direction. That's what I'd like to believe, because it seems like that was what was happening in like Normieville, you know, like the people, the parents who were being shamed into making their kids dress up for pride parades or whatever, finally were like, we're not doing this anymore, you know? And I think it had something to do with the trans movement. I think that finally the fathers were like, we don't want to see these men spiking balls into our, you know, volleyball playing daughters' faces. And we don't want them to be exposing themselves in these bathrooms. And I think, you know, so they had to sort of overplay their hands. And because I'm hopeful, I mean, I don't know, it's an interesting future to consider when we might actually be amongst sort of, you know, the cultural normative, or that there would be a sort of a, you know, Christianity, or at least the convictions that we have, whether it be explicit or implicit, at least would not be holding to views that have been labeled explicitly bigoted or explicitly, you know, out of step with where history is headed. It's an interesting thing to consider. I mean, I'm even in my own personal life, I feel somewhat similar to like when I left the Episcopal Church and was dealing with bishops and parishioners and even colleagues in the ACNA. Like, it took me, well, it's still sort of there, but it took me years really to kind of get over my defensive posture, you know, because I just assumed that anything that I said that was going to be, you know, traditional or in line with historic Christianity, particularly as it related to moral issues, was going to be met with shock and horror. And now, you know, you see that you can say things like, you know, it's good to be a man, it's good to be a woman, we should probably, you know, go back and talk about what it means to be a father. You know, these are sorts of conversations that people are having, you know, in the New York Times. You know, and it's just been amazing how rapid it's been, you know. And so I don't know, it's amazing. It's like they had an entire alternate, as they say, timeline ready to go. And it was just immediately implemented. I mean, it's only been 2.5 weeks since the inauguration. You know, it's been just a couple of months since the election, you know, and still.
I think we're seeing the reverse of what happened, say in the Episcopal Church, because, you know, I was shocked how fast the Episcopal Church collapsed, but in 2003 with the Gene Robinson, and how ready the vast majority of Episcopalians were to go along with it. I was shocked by that, but that's the result of like years and years and years of. Under the, you know, just subversion, right? Well, I think the same thing happened here. Like the years and years since 2010 or 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, I think people have been getting sick of the leftist ideology being pushed in every venue. And so while it seemed so powerful and so pervasive and so dominant, it really was standing, the foundation had been being sapped away. So all it took was Trump winning an election, or someone who's brave enough to say the truth and not back down to the longhouse that knocked all the wind out of the sails of the quote unquote woke. And I think that's why it was so quick. There was no substance underneath it anymore.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I do think that it's taken a while. And I think it's taken the church, Christian people a while to sort of figure out what they actually need to be convicted by, you know, I mean, like whether it's through the racism conversation that we had a couple of years ago, or through it's the same sex relationships, or now it's immigration. I think it's taken the church a while for sort of, again, the sort of pew normal Christian people to be able to digest some of these accusations and respond, and in fact receive some of them and just brush them off, you know. And I think I've been grateful. We've been trying to help people do that ever since we started this podcast. But I'm grateful to see that it seems like more and more churches are, at least the ones that are surviving, the ones that are growing in the midst of all this, are actually taking the responsibility of equipping their parishioners to withstand these inane attacks on traditional Christian understanding of reality, you know. And I was actually having a conversation with someone about that today, because we were talking about our conference that we're having, that y'all are coming to, which we're excited about. And I've been disheartened to have conversations with a number of people who are in churches where they have no idea what we're talking about. You know, they have no idea, it's like the need for, or why you would have a conference that needed to help equip people in the goodness of creation. And I said, well, goodness gracious, have you not been watching TV or listening to any of the, I guess they haven't been, you know, or maybe it seems so far disconnected. But from my perspective, I think it's obviously all part of a whole. And, you know, the challenges we're going to be facing, not just with respect to exterior, but internal just discussions about AI and transhumanism and, you know, the promise of all this reproductive technology. And then, of course, the end of life issues, all these things are interrelated in a way that I think, you know, are now the prospect of the conversation is entirely different than it was even in my mind, you know, 6 months ago. I mean, instead of being almost entirely defensive, it's almost like they might come to us and ask us for help. It's really interesting. I was talking about this in my rector's forum Sunday. I was like, I didn't think we were going to be in a season of reaping, but we very well may be, given the response to some of the more egregious overreaches of the woke over the last 10 years. Things that are going on in the church seem much more attractive than maybe 10 years ago I would have thought they would have been, given the trajectory we were on. Speaking of AI, have you utilized any of the numerous tools that I've been sending you to check out? Did you look at that notebook FM or whatever it's called that I sent you? You upload your sermon, yeah, and then it digests it and then puts it into a podcast form where a man and a woman, or whatever voices you want, begin discussing it critically. Well, in my case, with enthusiasm, which is laudatory, but you know, I can only imagine what it might be for a 45-minute sermon. But at any rate, but it was unbelievable. It really made me question whether or not some of the podcasts I'm listening to are in fact just AI podcasts. It's like, I'm going to go search for some real proof of life from some of these people, because this sounded more professional and more put together than a number of the podcasts that I routinely listen to. At any rate, it's all part of a whole.
Yeah, it was really hard to tell there was AI. Several tells, like they kept both the hosts had talking. They didn't have, there's no ing to the end of their whenever they come to an ing word, they would make a southernism, a weird southernism. You could kind of tell it's a weird tick, but otherwise it was good. It was great. I mean, I was like, I was listening to a regular podcast. I wouldn't have got that tick. I wouldn't. Yeah.
So evidently what's happening right now on college campuses, this is, I have this on firsthand account, is that at least some people are using these transcribing tools to audio record the lecture they're listening to, and then it gets downloaded. And then using these podcasts as sort of critical thinking ways to digest the information in a new way, so that they can retain it better. And I said, well, that doesn't sound like cheating. You know, they're not using that. And it sounds like something kind of cool. So I downloaded Owl AI, which Zoom uses, I think, and started using it for our staff meetings. Insane what they came up with. And then the best thing is they can make flashcards that will question you about the decisions that were made going forward. But it's all, again, all part of a whole, that there was this possibility of irreality, you know, the liquid modernity that melts everything, that is really more plausible than ever before. And I think that, you know, if you look at all the pieces that have fallen together, that something of real life is not only going to be more difficult to discern, particularly through a screen, but also it's going to be something that people that are celebrating real life are going to, it seems to be, at least be considered more attractive as a community. And who better than Christians, you know, to be on the forefront of that. You know, it's funny, I was just talking about AI and the Rector's Forum last Sunday, and we went immediately into church where we had the you know, we have all the vestments, we have all the candles and everything, and we had the bell choir was ringing. And you know, it's even an organ is somewhat mediated, but I was like, here we are, you know, just appropriate, just I was just pointed to me that we have this instrument that is nothing, it, no mediation at all. Like there's a clapper and there's metal and there's sound, and I was like, this is the exact opposite of what I was just talking about with the virtual reality and the transhumanism and the, you know, the lab grown meat and all this stuff. And I was really touched in a meaningful way, in a way that I would never have expected to be, by bells, that there's something so beautiful and real and tangible and glorious about the created order that something digital will never, never come close to replicating in any real way.
I can feel the fear like welling up inside me that I remember reviewing a book years ago for Modern Reformation called Sim Church, and it was about the potential future of church that was exclusively online and would potentially, you know, ship you communion wafers in the mail. I don't think that's really come to life in any real way, but you can see how, gosh, if they can start to just generate a podcast at the snap of the fingers discussing your sermon, it's probably already happening that your sermon in the first part is going to be generated by AI, and then it's only a matter of time before they don't need you to have put in the prompt. The church that was yours will fire you and just have an AI sermon generator. But having explained that and feeling that fear, we have somebody who had surgery in our church recently and so was homebound for a few weeks and just couldn't have been more effusive when she came back to church about how, as much as we can be in her home through her computer, through phone calls, whatever, being with the body of Christ in person with that, well, all the fleshiness and, you know, rain and snow and sleet and tripping over what, like all the uncomfortableness that necessarily entails was much more meaningful to her. That was how the gospel could actually be proclaimed in such a way that it seemed to me that it was almost like, as good as your AI sermon could be, it almost by definition can't be proclamatory of the gospel, that you need flesh and blood for that.
Amen. Yeah, I mean, it really calls into question the wisdom that the church showed when we so willingly shut down during COVID, you know, and went to quote unquote spiritual communion. You know, I mean, that was because we gave people, we taught people through that the wrong thing, I think. And, you know, no one asked me. I wasn't in a position to make much of a stink about it. But in retrospect, you know, I think it was set a bad precedent and taught the wrong message. And so we can repent of that, you know, we can correct it, and certainly we don't do it again. But to your point, Nick, it does bring into question, you know, the efficacy of these, even like the big platform, well, podcasts, not ours is a big platform, but people who have primary relationships to God through, you know, like a national sermon preacher or even online church, or, you know, some one of these kind of mediated platforms, as opposed to a local congregation, you know, full of sweaty sinners, you know, people that, you know, it's like, you know, which is never as sanitized. That's what I tell people all the time. Like, part of the discipleship process is dealing with the fact that the person behind you can't smell, can't sing, or has bad breath. You know, you got to be confronted with that, you know, hopefully not weekly. I mean, so it's okay to move around the church, but But at the very least, you got to confront that or be confronted by it. But yeah, it's all of the questions are now, I feel like, back on the table, and all of the answers, or many of the answers that we have been defending, you know, sort of against seemingly limitless adversaries, are now being considered and in a way that is, heartening and surprising. I mean, I was listening to a podcast this morning, the Breakpoint podcast, talking about, or may not have been this morning, about, you know, I think the title was, "Is God Having a Moment," you know, or whatever, but it was referencing the fact that, like, you know, these big name intellectuals are reconsidering things. You know, you just saw that the founder of Wikipedia became a Christian. You know, you see these high profile conversions, you see these high profile athletes, you know, speaking openly about their faith. You see these titans of industry, at least calling themselves cultural Christians. I mean, in a way that, again, I mean, I was, you know, I feel like I was trained for battle, for lack of a better word, in a different world than the one that I'm currently observing. And it feels pretty good. It's like, I'm like, you know, I feel like those guys who must have been, you know, came, they were like, the tragedy of the Pacific theater in World War II is their legion, is its legion. But the but one of the most poignant ones, in my opinion, was that they took the wounded from places like Iwo Jima and these terrible little islands, and they flew them to Hawaii to convalesce. And then they were like, okay, you look better, let's get back on that mud rock and get fighting again. And I feel, again, that's maybe a strange analogy, but like having been lifted from, you know, the one of these islands and where the fighting was so fierce, to convalesce for a minute in this place where people are actually talking about the things that we've been talking about for our lives, but particularly, you know, the past 5 to 6 years with great poignancy, in a way that, well, is very encouraging, you know? So I'm cautiously optimistic. I mean, we're never true optimists this side of heaven, but I think there's a seemingly a more clear avenue towards a clear post-mill reading of Revelation, Matt, than there was before.
Well, I mean, we suddenly slapped back into positive world, and if so, how does that work? I did hear you say, I'm having bad internet on my side of things, so, but I did hear you say, JD, that we were trained for a different, definitely a different theater of combat. I was expecting to be fighting or debating leftist ideas, leftist theological ideas and cultural ideas for my entire ministry. And it looked like until like 2 months ago, it looked like it was going to get worse and worse and worse and darker and darker and darker.
It's still could.
I think my read of things, though, is that the average person on the street feels really free suddenly to speak and to act in ways that were not possible. And the idea that I think as all these revelations have come out about how pervasive leftist ideology has become in, for example, sending or USAID using the money to infiltrate media resources all around the world to, yes, we're going to feed children in, say, Mozambique, but that's going to come along with funding for murdering babies in Mozambique. And passing out condoms in Mozambique. So you have this horrible web of influence that I had no idea how pervasive it was. All over the world, it's suddenly been, or at least it's not being totally dismantled yet. They just got started, but at least it's being exposed. And I think that's going to have a lasting effect or a lasting change. So when the people protesting Doge walk down the street in DC with a chance, and they try to break into the education department, they try to break into USAID. I think the average person watching that is thinking, oh man, these people, they just want their scam back. They want their grift back, because that's what's being exposed, is a scam and a grift that's pervaded our institutions, and we sought to export to other institutions. So I just, it just seems like everything that I thought was solid in a bad way, well, it turns out that it was interconnected. Like the media was interconnected with the government, and the universities were interconnected. Everything was interconnected. So it was one large system of corruption and propaganda that was being force fed to us and to all the world. But now that it's being dismantled, I don't see how we go back to that very quickly. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm overly optimistic, but I think people have seen the beast now, and I mean that in the fullest biblical sense. I think they've seen the beast now in the system, and I think it's be all the better for us.
So JD, why don't you respond to that real quick? Because I at least, when you asked earlier in the show about was Bud Light, for instance, just trying to capitalize financially on what they saw was a cultural moment, and now that they can capitalize financially on a different cultural moment, they're happy to do so. That seems to be not an accurate description of what Matt's talking about now, where we have this sort of interconnected beast that is being driven by an idea. We are exporting an idea to the world, not because we think it'll necessarily profit America. In fact, quite the opposite. It's not profiting America. We're exporting what we think is right and what we think the world ought to believe to get in line. How do those two things interconnect if they do at all?
Well, I think actually what Matt's describing is more in line with what I was hoping to be the case pragmatism. Because I think what we saw in the Christian world was manifest in even the non-Christian world, namely that you had your general person who was conflict averse, who, you know, had been fed a steady diet of self-loathing narrative, particularly, you know, sort of European, white Western European men for generation, about how all of the ills of society relate at the feet of, settler colonialism or whatever it was called. Mm-hmm. And so I think that when that was finally capitalized on and people began to rise to positions of power where they could weaponize that sort of then internalized guilt, I think that they took their opportunity, whether it was in education or whether it was in through these non-governmental organizations or even in corporate life. You know, you can't talk to me. You're not at this table because you're a man. You know, you're a cisgender heterosexual man or whatever the case may be, or you're a woman who believes traditional things about marriage. You know, or you're whatever the case is, you can be sidelined and silenced, and that took I don't know, I can't put a time on it, but if you take Aaron Wren's framework, that's at least been the last 25 years, you know, or so. And so you can make a lot of inroads in that amount of time, and you can make a lot of changes, you know, and I think that's what we have been experiencing. But I think that there came a point, like with the trans athletes, there came a point where, you know, people's children, well, I'll put it this way. I've got a friend of mine who lives out in San Francisco, and they are, you know, otherwise upstanding citizens and buying into all the things that you're supposed to. But that being said, they have a little boy, and, you know, we're in a school where they were begin teaching about the evils of masculinity and the toxic masculinity and how this, you know, that there needed to be safe spaces and just basically sidelining him from his, you know, from in preschool. And that started a train of thought that actually pushed them to remove their son from the school in a way that, you know, had you told them 10 years ago, they would have been horrified. Like, of course, this is the school the kid's going to go to. Of course, this is the trajectory he's going to be on. And I think that just took a while. I think it took a while for people to finally come to a place where they said enough is enough. You know, like if, you know, it's like back when we were talking about that summer of riots, like if every single thing is racist, well, then nothing's racist. You know, if every single thing is just a power play and some sort of thinly veiled or Marxist, it can be interpreted along Marxist power and oppression lines. Well, then eventually, if you have any responsibility, you're just going to say, whatever you say, I've got to move, I've got to live. And if I am abusing my power, I hope I'm not. You know, if I'm being impressive, I hope I'm not. I don't think I'm, you know, the most evil, toxic, masculine man in the world. But if you're going to say it regardless, well, then I'm just going to have to, you know, raise my kids, protect my family, and hopefully be a good citizen. You know, I think that was under the surface. And I think to your point, Matt, the speed at which we're seeing it is, I think, mainly because most of the people agreed with that, you know, in these companies. Like I think people in Bud Light were lamenting. You know, I think you got a lot of mid-level managers in that company, you know, vice presidents, whatever, who I think loved the Clydesdale Christmas commercial, you know, probably teared up. That's probably why they worked for Bud Light in part, you know, and is things like that. And then to have it just mocked and eviscerated with this, with that crazy Dylan Mulvaney person was just a step too far. So, I mean, that's why I'm hoping that that's the case. And I think that this exposing the grift and the ideology behind the unelected, the true unelected power in all these government agencies, you know, I mean, the fact someone was talking the other day, like, have you ever in your own life said something as ridiculous? Like, well, it's only $50 million, you know, it was only two $10 million grants. Like, I mean, why are you so upset? I mean, like, these are the type of conversations people are having, and just saying it out loud shows you how ridiculous it is. And so I have a lot of hope. I don't know. I mean, and it's not in one man, for goodness sakes. It's not in a party even. It's in the fact that all things done in darkness will be brought to light. And that, you know, that the flip side of the evils of the internet is the positive. And that is that, you know, you can't get away with anything anymore. And we actually have spreadsheets that you can run our $50 trillion budget through, and they can spit it out, and AI can parse it out for you in 2 seconds. I mean, that could never have happened even 5 years ago. And now we, you know, it's like we got real time spending down to like the, you know, the corporate credit card from the intern at someone's Senate office. You know, it's like, yeah, you're going to have to think twice about buying that Starbucks kid. You know, we know how much you, what the budget is. So I don't know. I mean, I'm, you know, we might be back here next week, and obviously everything's changed just as quickly back the other way. So, I mean, I won't hold my breath, but I'm grateful for a little reprieve at the moment, and I'm enjoying it, I have to say.
So Matt, I think I know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask you anyway. As a preacher and minister of the gospel, does the message and or the way the message is presented change in quote unquote positive world, now that we're at least feeling like that for a little while, than it did in negative world, neutral world, et cetera? Now that we're in the world of Donald Trump and Elon Musk, does the mission and ministry of the church look different?
Not necessarily, but okay, so let's say that it really is a sudden shift back to positive world, and suddenly people want to be Christians again. People were like, let's say we have all the churches, all the conservative churches start reaping in vast growth in numbers, and the culture shifts so thoroughly back to conservatism there's really nothing. Well, there's very less things to critique than there have been. Well, then I think the problem becomes maybe what you had in 400, 300 AD, where the church went from being a minority, a very small persecuted minority, where to join the church meant very often signing your own death warrant, which means you only get true believers. You don't get people who are just walking into the church in the second century. You don't get people coming into the church because of a social status cue, right? You might now, though. You might have people posing as Christians, posing as believers. In the fourth century, you had churches that were full, churches being built, and they were full of people who were Christians because the emperor is a Christian and the state is a Christian state, and you're not going to get anywhere if you're not a Christian. So that's the kind of thing I think we'd have to watch out for. Like the new, if we did live in the positive world, the thing that we want to preach toward is and guard against is nominal belief, like just said only faith, and you'd want to say, hey, do these people really know the gospel? Do they know who Jesus is? Or is the church again, has it become just a social marker of status and acceptability? So, and it can be like that too nowadays, but I think in a positive world, that's the main thread, is people belonging to the church but not to Christ.
Do you think we can expect,
if we go to positive world, a return to sort of mediocre kind of Christian rock music? That
please, maybe Creed will do the halftime show again. Bring this right back full circle. What,
Creed, Carmen. Are we going to get Carmen? Are we going to get Petra? Are we going to get Newsboys back together? That one that became an atheist is going to get rebaptized. It's going to be awesome. Like the whole Toby Mac is going to fly down. Yeah. Yeah, whatever his name is. Burlap to Cashmere is going to get back together.
That's a deep cut right there.
Yeah, that's right. Sidewalk Prophets with that one. And then there's that one that everyone still likes. Skillet. Is it Skillet? No, Skillet. Switchfoot. I mean,
Switchfoot exists as well.
Like, Switchfoot's got like a real... That's right. Well, that's one thing to pray about, and really in hopeful expectation, because this creed is part of the, that's hashtag postmill right there. DC Talk comes back together and goes on a tour. Jesus Freak 2028. I'll be there. And Jennifer Knapp, you know, she can divorce her wife and get recommitted, you know, things like this. So there's a whole list of Dan Hazeltine come back, you know. Anyway, Lord.
From your lips to God's ears.
Amen.
Well, it's been a free-flowing conversation. We never did have a sort of topic. We'll have to see what we do in terms of title for this episode. We're all over the place. But thank you for listening to Stand Firm this week. If you want to keep this conversation such as it is going, be in touch with us, rate and review the podcast on iTunes, send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com, follow us on social media, join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Hope to see all you guys later this month in Hilton Head for this conference. Thanks to J.D. Koch and Matt Kennedy. I'm Nick Lannon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.